background, take us through many of the issues that we want to address here in this conference. I'm going to take a quick look at the world the frontier is seen from 1987. Then, of course, what we want to shed light on is the theory of inflation and dark energy, perhaps also in inflation. Going, and of course, the name of the game now is to go beyond the cosmic standard model in quest of the subdominant and the anomalous, and we know that the anomalous is, there are certainly anomalies out there, but we don't know whether they're subdominant phenomena from the fundamental sense or not, and some of them, we may never know this because of sample variance or cosmic variance. I'll mention a little bit about dark energy and ways to look at it that are a little different than what had been done by other people, but intimately related. I'll talk a little bit about the low-resolution polarization frontier that's associated with the B modes and the quest for primordial gravity waves. One of the big questions from the fundamental physics point of view is whether it will be large enough to actually detect the tensor component by all experiments, including conceivable ones. I'll spend some time talking a little bit about the new generation of experiments and how to have them interact with each other and what looks particularly promising in terms of the desire to go for towards a detection. Then I will take us into a little bit of cosmic dirt and weather, namely the high-resolution frontier in which nonlinearities are actually fundamental in terms of trying to understand what's going on. Along the way, all of the issues that we are confronted with in this subject are at the leading edge of computational capability. So I'll say a few words about various aspects of the computational horizon. One interesting issue, we have all focused a lot on what the great promise of low-resolution polarization will be, namely the possible detection of the R mode, but not quite as interesting, but very interesting indeed, is the high-resolution polarization frontier. In particular, as you know, there is a turn of the E mode of polarization, which is the classic thing generated by scalar fluctuations, just by virtue of the lensing effect. Some of that gets turned into the B mode, which provides a very interesting signal to search for things like gravitational lensing. And the other aspect, this is sort of the summary of where we're going, is that if you go for resolution, you can actually, for polarization, you can actually go further down the damping tail, which allows you to place better limits on various parameters. What I probably won't have time to do is talk about the non-Gaussian frontier, which is another one, but it is going to be much discussed at this conference. And of course, we have great hopes for Planck, improving the limits and possibly making detections in the future. So just going back to 1987, the thing that is quite striking is though we all think that we're all leading edge, most of the issues that we discuss within the relationship of fundamental physics and microwave background and large-scale structure, we're already on the table, and most of the things, future detector is the key thing that has enabled the great progress, but things like the statistics, whether it's Gaussian, whether it's got non-Gaussian components, polarization, microwave or gravitational waves inducing delta T over T, all of these things were already on the table at that time. The fundamental aspect of secondary fluctuations associated with thermal upscattering of hot gas, also called the Sinyaya-Zeldovich effect, effects of primeval dust emission, radio sources, all of the things that we have to deal with on a daily basis today were already well in play then, as well as specific predictions that were been borne out in detail as the subject has progressed. This is a very small field from Boomerang 2005 polarization release, with these being the temperature fluctuations and these non-headed little lines being the polarization pattern as determined from the polarization pattern is determined from polarization-sensitive bolometers. As we move through this, those same class of polarization-sensitive bolometers are the central engine for Planck. And what Planck does, even at higher resolution and at more frequencies, it takes a map like this, which is only a few hundred square degrees, and does it over the entire sky with the remarkable amount of information that that delivers. And that is actually not a bad indication in the sense that the noise that it gets to is quite similar to the noise that was obtained
here.
I am happy to say that Canada has been heavily involved in the microwave background. This was actually a slide that was a story to sell to funding people of how significant our Canadian interaction on this subject has been as we move from COBE through WMAP. This is a simulation of Planck. And then at high resolution, there have been a number of experiments that go for much smaller regions of the sky. An example that we've been involved in or quite excited about is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, but also there's a South Pole Telescope. And both of those are going to polarization. That's the high resolution polarization issue. And you can see that even with Planck, this is the sort of resolution. And the resolution you get with these burrowing in ground-based experiments with orders of magnitude more bolometers, you get a much finer resolution, which can back act with Planck to help to clean it, but also delivering fundamental information on its own right. And so this is a really powerful progressive path that we are on in the subject with everything interplaying with everything else. And so this is a snapshot. It's not completely exhaustive of the way the a power spectrum in the microwave background looks, with WMAP dominating the scene up to about here, and then other experiments take over as one moves down the damping tail. What you can't see here, and what I'm going to try and show you in a little more detail associated with the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, is that we've actually been able to resolve seven of the peaks. And so it's absolutely amazing story. As you know, that theoretical curve is one that's motivated by inflationary models. So what do we learn about? Well, if you want to go beyond just your basic amplitude and slope of the spectrum, what you're really trying to do is to learn about acceleration. And so this set of figures here is a summary of what we know about the acceleration trajectories. There is a best fit and then a set of one sigma trajectories that are associated with this. So the way that this is defined is in terms of the logarithmic derivative of the expansion factor, and that's also called 1 plus the deceleration parameter. It's really an acceleration parameter. And in the slow roll limit, it is the classic slow roll parameter, but it's more general than that. And so this is an example over wave number, three-dimensional wave number, going over 10 e-folds. And the thing that is so amazing that I love to tweak our audience with, especially those that are more astronomical, is that the paradox of the microwave background and other information, because of a relationship that exists between resolution, that is to say wave number, and the Hubble parameter times A, that is to say dynamics, that is more or less correct, is that we can learn a lot more about the ultra-early universe than the early stage of inflation, rather than the late stage of inflation, which is giving us information going back to about the most distant supernova we know of, at least at the moment. It only gives us information of about one e-folding in expansion rather than about 10. We actually, in principle, have more information for the very high resolution thing, but that goes into high nonlinearity, and to unravel it is not so simple, although one can. And then over here we have super horizon scales, which we can access, but only in a very, not a very exceptional way. We get tails of things, very low gradients. And so those are obviously all sorts of issues which arise when one's asking about any of the microwave background anomalies. Anyway, this is not the way that you're probably used to thinking about some of this in terms of trajectories. This particular class, and I won't go into the details, what you do is you have of order some number of parameters that are characterizing the paths or the trajectories of acceleration. And then you pass that through appropriate likelihood codes, and you find out what is allowed and what not. As you can see, these trajectories have a certain coherence. What has actually been happening is that there are various nodal points along this path, which are the amplitudes that it's being projected on, and there's a certain smoothness associated with these trajectories, which means that it's got some prior probability associated with those amplitudes. So there is, in fact, prior probabilities, like any statistical analysis that goes into it, the measures that you put on the variables that you expand in, for example. But in a sense, this is a semi-blind analysis because there's seven parameters and there is no physics behind those parameters except for some kind of smoothness criteria, and the idea being that if you want to discover things, you would like to be as blind as possible. Here is the way the reconstruction of the trajectories looks now in terms of the acceleration parameter. This is not exactly the W of the dark energy. This is the total W associated with the total pressure to density ratio. And so as you go back in redshift, it is going asymptotically to the 1.5. There is a certain coherence. This is the best fit. This is the best fit if you restrict yourself to a lambda cosmology, and this is sort of the one sigma variation of paths. And so it shows, yes, there's a certain amount of possibilities. This is not a semi-blind analysis. You can do semi-blind. We have done them. By the way, let me mention that when I say we, I mean he, that is to say Shi Ji Wang up there. And Lev Kaufman has been, our good friend, has been heavily engaged in this whole process as well, which has been a multi-year effort. And we have some new ways of doing this that allow us to go way up to asymptotically high redshift. Anyway, the bottom line is that the scales associated with these fluctuations are much bigger than the scales associated with these fluctuations, which is another manifestation of the fact that we have a lot more information here because of this resolution to dynamics relation. This is not the way we think things should be looked at, but this is the conventional way that things are being looked at, for example, with the Dark Energy Task Force, which is an expansion of the dark energy pressure to density ratio in terms of some constant plus something that's varying linearly with A. There are many ways you can do this sort of expansion. This is in some sense sort of like a running of the expansion as you go away from redshift now, that is to say A equals 1. So here we have one of the parameters, here we have another one, and the interesting thing about this figure is that these are the current constraints, 1 sigma, 2 sigma, for everything and the kitchen sink beside thrown in to try and analyze how close we are getting. And so you can see, yes, indeed, the zero here, or sorry, this minus one here is, of course, our famous cosmological constant. And yes, that's a pretty good description, but with this kind of error. A question is where we will go with this, and there was a specific path that was discussed within the Dark Energy Task Force, but we didn't follow that path. We used experiments as they are in play and going to happen, or at least we hope that they will happen. For example, Planck, 2.5 years of observations, which is what we hope to get, and we're certainly on the track for that. Euclid, which is a European experiment that looks like it might happen somewhat downstream. Supernova, this would do weak lensing, it'll do baryon acoustic oscillations. JDEM will do all of these things if it's independently funded and it doesn't just join forces with the Euclid satellite, which is also an option. But anyway, this is adding some of the supernova stuff. The supernova is a little more awkward because we don't know the level at which we're hitting the systematic floor with supernovas, so how accurate it will be, because everything that's done with the great supernova results has been phenomenological, and it is not purely theoretical. The theory is there, but the theory is about an order of magnitude off of what would be needed in order to do this diagram, and so everything is done phenomenologically in terms of the putting together statistics of the supernova that have been observed. There is another thing that we're very excited about here in Canada. C here is for the H. It involves redshifted 21 centimeter, but instead of targeting the reionization epoch at redshift about 10, it is in fact focusing on redshift about 2 and looking at, on very broad brushstrokes, the influence of galaxies. And what can be done with that is that you, for a much cheaper price than satellite experiments, orders and orders of magnitude, by the way, you could in principle get a large fraction of this figure. And so it would be sighted, we hope, at the Dominion Radio Astronomical Observatory in Penticton. And I'm saying this is because, in spite of PI being a fundamental theory institute, we're trying to convince our good friend Neil Turek that this is as fundamental as you can get, because it's going after lambda. Anyway, there are features which are, in fact, appropriate for PI to get engaged with, as well as with us in various realms across Canada. Just as a ridiculous number, just to bring your eye to, remember that the way these things used to be done with not doing this two-level expansion, you just do the single W, constant W. And here is the current error bars, if you believe all of the ingredients that are going on to this and that the systematics have been well understood. And this, startling enough, is with this combination of experiments is what one seems to be able to get to, which is really quite dramatic, much better than the class of experiments that we thought were on play a while ago. So this is actually a very promising development in terms of the subject. And I was going to further extol the virtues of CHIME, but I've done that. I've already sold Neil on the virtues, so away we go. Right, so the way that we've been doing the informed trajectories for dark energy is in terms of a fitting formula that involves three parameters. Any of you who have heard either Shiji or me talk about this in the past might note that there was another parameterization we were using, and this one that we're using now is, we believe, much superior, much more physically motivated, and it's the idea is to pave essentially all of the trajectories of the dark energy equation of state with high accuracy with just three parameters, so that if you can constrain those three parameters, you have in effect constrained an entire class of models, which may or may not have anything to do with it. There are many friends of mine who say it's lambda, it cannot be anything but lambda, my prior is lambda. Why are you bothering? But that's another way to say it is, prove to me that it's lambda, which is trying to get these error bars down. But even those practitioners would say, yes, but even if you tunnel, you may tunnel into a dynamical situation before you get to the uniform lambda. So there could be dynamics. The dynamics is something that even within, I think, a landscape model, I'm looking at the guru of this subject to see if I get a nod or a shake, that it may well be that there could be some residual dynamics as one is going down to a lambda that you don't necessarily tunnel into the bottom. Okay, anyway, that was just an aside. Okay, see, he'll hit me later. Anyway, so there are a couple of parameters. The most important is the logarithmic gradient of the potential, and it turns out that that's the thing which is best determined by around a pivot point, which is when the density in matter is equal to the density in the lambda or lambda equivalent, the quintessence field. And that turns out to be a parameter which in some sense replaces, in terms of measurability, the W naught parameter which is being used. But the rest of this parameterization is also an important one because they're very different than the class of parameters. One is associated with the dark energy equation of state at very high redshift. This was a sort of extra innervation. And another one is associated with another derivative of the logarithmic potential. And the basic lesson that we've learned from these results is that this is very hard to measure. And that this one is easy. That's the thing in most of the constraints. And this one will eventually be measurable as well. So here are some examples of trajectories of W for various sorts of potentials. Here is the minus 0.5 value, which is pretty dramatically out there. And the blue lines are the fits associated with the fitting formula, and red is the exact trajectories. This is for a pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson model of the dark energy, which is probably one of the better ones that's on the market, to the extent that there are any good ones on the market. But the idea here is that you become agnostic of what the specific form of the potential is, and you just see what can we actually get at here in terms of the observables. And let me remind you once again, it's not completely unlike early universe inflation, which is that early universe, we'll see this in a moment, early universe inflation is allowing us to access only a relatively small amount of the potential surface. And the same thing goes here, but even more so. We're not actually moving a lot along that potential, so you will not be able to do massive reconstructions, and that's the lesson of the work. But just to show you something that we think is rather amazing, and Shiji pulled this out of the hat, which is that this simple parameterization allows you to go from this 1E fold where the data is the best in terms of constraining dark energy issues all the way back to arbitrarily many. Here is minus, this is 10 E foldings in the past, this is 20 E foldings. It's got some interesting issues at the very beginning, but it's absolutely remarkable. What does this mean? It means that this very large class of models, we can actually address such issues as any anomalies that might occur, which we don't think are likely to be there, associated with Big Bang nucleosynthesis or just the passage through recombination, and are there any imprints. So at least in this regard, it is a nice extension. Before, we had formulas that were just focusing on the lower redshift where the data was. And that's a viable thing to do as well, but we think that this is better motivated. And essentially, the results are the same as we were getting before in terms of the limits. So how is all of the data coming together on the dark energy? Here is our parameter epsilon s. We've already seen the other things. So this is analogous to W-naught, but it's a better parameter. It's the square of the logarithmic gradient. Zero means that it's flat, which means that it's essentially cosmological constant. Extension to minus one is sort of silly, so think about as if we wanted to X this out, because that is the phantom regime, and the phantom regime is if you have any sort of respectable prior, your respectable prior would be to say that's pretty excluded. So, but it is conventional in dealing with the dark energy story to try and extend things down there just so that one shows something which doesn't have a, not artificial, but a strict boundary zero line. But you could just get rid of that. In any case, here we have CMB. This is current data. And we have a supernova, supernova plus CMB, and all of the data, including weak lensing, which is actually, at least the current data, is adding a little bit of oomph to this, rather surprisingly, perhaps, because the weak lensing results have been jumping around a little bit. But anyway, that's the way it looks. And if we go to the future, notice the difference between this scale, this is omega matter, by the way, this scale and this scale. So this would be with JDAM-type supernova. Built into this entire thing would be the assumption that Planck will inform all aspects. And what it mainly informs is omega m It doesn't learn a lot about W or about epsilon S itself, a little bit. But in any case, we add supernova. We add weak lensing from Euclid. We add baryon acoustic oscillations with the important ingredient of assuming that Chime will get funded and that Neil will support it. You can see that lobby is what this is all about. Anyway, and this is where it would go, and this would be the error. But the way to look at this is, here's where we are now for this particular variable with a plus and minus 0.18, and it will improve by a factor of order 6. By the same token, that factor of order 6 is reflected in the W-naught improvement. So we are really looking at a fine honing of the issue of the equation of state for dark energy as we move through experiments which are actually on the table that they're going to happen in the future. That's assuming all systematics are solved, and there is no question they will be solved. That's a slight piece of humor for those in the game. I was going to show you about the other variables, but let me just say that right at the moment, the one we call it a tracking variable is not that well determined, but will be as well. And then the one doing the logarithmic gradients requires an exceptionally weird model to be able to get it. That is to say, you get essentially the gradient of the potential, but you don't get how that's curved around beyond the gradient. But if it's a very steep thing, then you can, in fact, get that too. Okay, a summary of this. Our trajectories, and the way to look at this is, once again, we have the one sigma. Instead of doing what I showed before, which was the acceleration, this is the dark energy equation of state, and these are the trajectories as we go back over 1E folding from now. The reason that these lines are here is just a way of encoding this one sigma variation. Everything is centered around zero, which is cosmological constant. That's current data. If you look, for example, in supernova, and supernova for more than a year, perhaps almost 2 years, we've been waiting and waiting for the next version of the CFHT legacy survey supernova data. But this is the current set of which the legacy survey is still one of the dominant ingredients. And this is the luminosity distance, where zero corresponds to a reference, that is to say, lambda-type model. And you see that these are the error bars. They allow quite a bit of movement in it. And we have these trajectories, which are all centered around the zero, but with some appropriate change. Let's look to the future. So this is another way to look at it. These bundles of trajectories allowed, here's now again, will focus into some region if cosmological constant was the answer, with pretty small variations. And that's a pretty interesting thing. But let me say that there would be oscillations on this if we did a semi-blind analysis. But if you do one which is informed by trajectories, which are trajectories that would come from something like an effective scalar field model like quintessence, then this is the sort of thing that you would get. This doesn't describe every single model, but it describes the largest fraction by far. And of course, that's a way of saying that W equals minus 1. OK, so let's go back now to the early universe acceleration trajectories. And from those, as is well known, and it's been a goal of many, many years, but not so much materialized, is you can use these trajectories. The specific expansion basis doesn't matter that much. It matters somewhat. The measures on this do matter. But anyway, here we have our acceleration trajectories. And from this, by various approximate relations, you can reconstruct, based upon this epsilon, the change of the field with respect to log A, and therefore the field modulo a constant offset. Is related to the square root of epsilon, and the potential is related to the Hubble parameter, which is derivable because of this integration from epsilon, so everything can be so determined. And so there is a pivot point on the value of the potential, and these are the allowed trajectories of the potential that currently exist with the data, all of the data right now. My view is that this should permeate the analysis of Planck. And of course, it is my role to try and perturb us in that direction, as opposed to just doing the conventional way, which is certainly something we will be doing. It said pi, and I thought you were giving me 3 point so and so minute. Anyway, there are many ways to try and do that potential reconstruction along the same way that we deal with the running of the spectral index. For example, this is a running about some pivot point to fourth order, and you get these sorts of trajectories looking rather than different than this. It's all associated with prior probabilities. And if you require that your field is not allowed to move more than M Planck, which is something that may or may not be a fundamental rule of nature, but it is certainly in play within the stringy cosmology game, then this would be the reconstruction, of course, with movement that is not allowed to be very big and turns out with rather reduced error bars. So now let me turn to our futures and what is extremely exciting to us at CETA and to many other people in the community. First and foremost was the launch of Planck about a year ago, happily out there at L2, 1.5 million kilometers away. It is now into its second all-sky survey. We hope to get 5 of them. And that is amazing. The original target was finished 2, and that would be game over, done, and really fabulous. But it turns out that the loss of coolant is actually much slower, and so it gives the hope for this, not the requirement of this. Here is the launch. Here is the principal investigator of the high-frequency instrument, which has those polarization-sensitive bolometers that I was talking about. Here we are at in French Guiana, where the launch occurred. That's passion fruit. And anyway, it's a fabulous, fabulous event. Very emotional for everybody who spent so many years involved in it. That's my good friend, George Stathy. You can't see him there, who's been engaged for a very long time as well. One hopes to use it, plus these other experiments, to go after these fundamental physics things. The scalar spectrum is a function of wave number, neutrino masses. The tensor to scalar ratio is a function of wave number, if possible. We'll see that's not quite feasible. Beyond FNL and the non-Gaussian quest for primordial non-Gaussianness, even if it's highly subdominant, issues associated, which we've already discussed, the dark energy equation of state as a function of time, and then other subdominant phenomena of great interest to certain individuals, especially in the audience, as I look to Neil, strings, isocurvature perturbations, etc. As well, though, with Planck, there is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is something that Licia Verdi here is involved with, as well as me, and many, many other people that I'll be referring to in a minute. And it's going to go to a polarized version of ACT, and that will aid in this process enormously. As well, there's a SPIDER balloon. Both of these, this one has about 2,000 bolometers. This one will have about 2,300 bolometers. This one, that's 3,000 actually. And not all are working all the time, but it's been very, very impressive. And this one, Planck, only has 52 bolometers, so it's a dramatic, dramatic technological advance that allow these ground-based and space-based and balloon-based experiments to be competitive with something that sits up there for 2.5 years and integrates and integrates. Okay, this is very well known to this audience, so I won't spend any time on this. But just if we go to the models of the 80s, 90s, 2000s on the tensor to scalar ratio, the classic range is about 0.3 to 0.03 to about 0.5. There certainly were many models on the table that would have much lower values. Some would have argued even in those days that they were the more natural ones. And the key feature of the class of models that gives this thing is well known is that the field moves more than the Planck mass. And so if you think that's a fundamental limitation, then you would say these aren't viable from the theoretical point of view, but if you are going to cross those out, then you have to go to models which are also, in my view, even though we've worked on them, rather unhappy ones as well, because it involves a highly variable form of the breaking as one is moving down towards epsilon equals 1, which is when preheating occurs, that it has to be shaped sort of in just the right way in order to get NS, as well as an extremely small value of R. That's not to say it can't happen, and indeed there are models where that does happen. That's the small field inflation models, with this is the sort of number that you go beyond below. But there have been models that have been constructed. Eva Silverstein was probably the first one to say there is no such no-go theorem here. Let's deal with the monodromy, and the current version of that is a cosine potential plus a linear potential. And it gives values which are quite accessible to what we can get. As well, as you know, there are inflation consistency relationships which you can either impose or try and test. Ideally, you would like to test them to make everything self-consistent, and they relate R, the tensor slope, to this acceleration, and the NS to the derivative of the acceleration. If you make this tiny, you are then having to make sure that this logarithmic change is exactly tuned to give you the NS that we observe. Okay, I'm going to skip over this. This is too boring. The only thing that is of interest here is that with Planck 2.5, the current WMAP figure with, in fact, now going after the B mode of polarization takes you down to this regime. So a tremendous improvement. All right. I think that I am going to, I can't even read it. Right. Okay. Just a further expression of this acceleration game. You can do things in a more blind way and not have any consistency between tensor and scalar. And so these are the trajectories as a function of K that you get for the scalar power spectrum and the tensor power spectrum. The tensor only has the R and T relation. We have put in more complex semi-blind analyses, but there's just no hope for determining anything beyond two parameters. And as we shall see, you don't even get the second parameter in T. So then the response of what is allowed looks like this for the B mode of polarization, this being associated with weak lensing and this being associated with the classic tensor things. And there are two significant regimes here. One is an effect on the B mode associated with the reionization of the universe, and the other one is the standard signal. So you can choose, shall we target this? Shall we target this? You don't want to build an experiment to target this if you're interested in a detection. So it turns out that we've done a lot of work on this, and we came to the interesting conclusion, which many other people who are trying to push the experiments have come to, that if you really want to go for it, you concentrate your observing time on this region here. And so that means that you don't necessarily go for the whole sky to go after R, you go after a small region. But what Planck is already doing for us, it is accessing this large region. So the combination of these two is actually quite powerful if Planck can actually deliver. And this is, we won't bother with this. This is what happens when you enforce consistency. And I'll skip over this, which is what a detection might look at, and go to what futures would be. So the only thing to take away from this, this has sort of the usual things that we saw that were put in for the forecasting of the future when we dealt with the dark energy trajectories. Now we're dealing with the scalar fluctuation power trajectories and the tensor trajectories that are allowed at the one sigma level. And the thing to most note as you compare it with this, with the scales about the same, is the infinitesimal nature in the observable range of how small the error bars are. That is to say, it's going to be a remarkable future. And what you won't be able to do is to live with models where you have, assuming it is this, big fluctuations, or if they're there, we'll be able to find it. So radical scale invariance will be very well constrained by Planck and by, as well, by Spider. Okay, I was going to say more, but I'm going to skip over it, that the best thing to do I prefer to it as the 0.7% solution, 007. But in fact, we think somewhere between about 8 and 12% of the sky is the thing to best be targeting for if you want to get the smallest error bars on the R parameter. And in fact, that's what we're moving towards with our decisions on what to do for SPIDER. Anyway, this is also including some foreground things, but it's not as fundamental, except for those that are doing the experiments. So let me just fast forward to the way the world might look. If there were a R of 0.12 that was built in, that was, for example, associated with an M squared phi squared, so that's what we were trying to determine. And this is the way it would look with Planck, with SPIDER, and with the combination. And then this yellow is if there were some future microwave background polarization satellite that would have some very large bank of detectors of great sensitivity, 10,000 or so. And here's R, and here's this NT, which should be related by this line, which is the consistency relation. You can see that that will not be determined to any sensitivity at all. Here's what SPIDER can do. Here's what Planck could, in principle, do. Not quite as well with the foregrounds taken into account. This is the combination as one burrows down, leading to about plus or minus 0.02 in errors. And if it was something that was more the string-based modular models, then which can give you values somewhere in the 10 to the minus 10 range, or possibly if it's monodromy or something like it in this range, it will be able to actually get to this, which is pretty remarkable. So all of the models with these sorts of values, this is the logarithmic, anyway, you don't want to get into the details of this. This will give a less than 0.02 at 95% confidence limit if we're just dealing with an upper limit. And this is actually, as I said, taking into account at some level the foregrounds, which is the biggest issue apart from making sure that all of the experiments are perfectly designed because, as you know, the B mode is really, really tiny. And it is a remarkable thing that people are able to develop experiments that should be able to beat that in those systematics. Okay, I am going to, in 2 minutes remaining, skip over cosmic weather, tragically, except to point, because Lisa is in the audience, and I think she's not talking about it, we have to say something to impress you with ACT. In January, we released a power spectrum from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and a bit earlier, so did the South Pole Telescope. And here we have a primary CMB with all of these computed bumps that would exist in it. And these were the data points we released then, and it also was in good agreement with WMAP. This is supposed to show the morphing of WMAP into ACT. But what Suzanne Staggs, when she was here in April, showed is as yet unpublished, thus the word preliminary, higher resolution treatment of the data that was used for the Fowler et al. Paper in January. And you probably, if you used your imagination, you would see that you could count up 7 rises here. And in fact, if you, instead of dealing with the L squared multiplier, which gives you power per logarithmic L, if you multiply by an extra L squared so that this gets kicked up, it becomes much clearer what it is that's been observed, namely that there really are able to count up to 7 peaks. And then the trouble is, if you're in that high resolution regime, you are dealing with all of these things that contaminate the world. Here's Lens CMB coming down. There are point sources. The point sources are clustered, complicating this. Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect is coming in. That's a fundamental thing from the cosmological perspective that we want to measure. And so unraveling all of this, marginalizing over all of this stuff to go after all of this peaky thing is not an easy task. It is the next big task that we have with the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and we will have a whole series of papers dealing with this and dealing with it as best we can, which will be, we like to think, pretty good. This was just part of the advertisements. I'm going to get over this and go to, this is really a great figure, but Bernard is yelling at me virtually. I can hear him. So what is coming for ACT as we go to the higher resolution regime? We are there in terms of the total intensity, the temperature fluctuations. And there is much more data to come, and there is for the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, or sorry, the South Pole Telescope, so that this terrain is going to open up with higher and higher precision, and you should just watch for that. And we only delivered on the 150 gigahertz. We have much more data there, but we also have a lot of information at the Sinyaev-Zeldovich-Knoll at 218 gigahertz and information at 277 gigahertz. You put it all together, you get to subtract off some of these things like submillimeter galaxies, et cetera. So that's a complex issue, but it's one that certainly is well underway. And there's lots of things that we can get out of that, but it is not easy to use this tremendously extended baseline because of these other components, the secondary components, to go into the extreme part of the damping tail. Now, why do we want to do that? It's because it provides a bigger lever arm for determining what the spectral index is, the NS of the scalar perturbations, and in particular, whether there's running or structure in it. As well, it turns out that that regime is a very good one to use if you wanted to try and further constrain the neutrino mass. So that is also being done, and that will also be done nicely as well with the Planck information. But as I mentioned earlier, with E and B polarization, it turns out that the secondary sources, the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, thermal Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, dusty galaxies, are just not very polarized. What that means is that where we saw all of those secondaries rising to do contamination down that damping tail, it shifted over enormously, extremely small, and so we do get to go further down. And so if you can do that with precision, you get a lot more information. And the lensing associated with it, which is generating BMO, gives a lot more information. And we just learned that the NSF has had the wisdom to fund the polarization extension of ACT, and it'll be about five more times more sensitive, but it will also have this incredible polarization sensitivity. And what I have discussed today, beyond the standard parameters, we've gone into trajectory parameters. And what I did not get to go into, but I will bend people's ear over drinks, is the other aspect, the later time aspect of the talk, which was going to be on aspects of primordial non-Gaussianity, but that dog will be walked very much in the course of this meeting. But we have a really neat version of this. But that I will pass on for now. It involved our good friend Lev Kaufman. And I will end with this magnificent figure of what's happening in our subject as we went in the WMAP era. By the way, they finish observations later this year. And Planck, of course, has taken over. Oh, the one thing I thought I would say, imagine a map, an all-sky map of higher resolution than WMAP that involves multiple frequencies. Have you got that in your mind? So I was very pleased. There are two events. One was a very sad event. Jean-Luc Puget, the PI of the HFI instrument, he got the special permission to show a version as of a few weeks ago at the memorial for our good friend Andrew Lang, Caltech, who is the US PI for the HFI experiment, to show that map of the current data of Planck. Of course, nobody could take pictures because it was all classified in the Bondian sense. I was very pleased that at the CETA 25 festivities, May 15th, Boucher got permission to show an even more updated one because the data evolved between in that whole week, at least the analysis of it. And so what happened at both meetings is that there was an unbelievable gasp, tremendous explosion of hand clapping, et cetera, because Planck is in fact delivering, and we can say that much. The problem is the cosmology of Planck will not, in the current timescale, be delivered until December 2012, which is a bit sad. There will be those of us, Ruth and whoever else is involved in the audience, we will know the answer, and we won't be able to speak, and there are monitors of us talking in our sleep to try and perturb this. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Dick. Yeah, we started 10 minutes late, so can we finish 15 minutes late for this talk? Okay, so just a few moments for gasps or questions.
I think there's a class of things you didn't touch on very much, which is trying to probe what was happening before inflation began. That stuff that's all at long wavelengths. It's, you know, the spatial curvature, L equals 1, isocurvature, L equals 2, the B modes and E modes in there. To what extent are we going to get additional bits of data improving the bounds on the spatial curvature, or additional bits of data about the E modes and B modes at such long wavelengths?
The the B modes, it gave you some idea of where we were headed, and I won't bother going back to it. I'll just describe it. So the expectation is that we are going to get a very good B mode constraints or maybe detections from let me be clear. So you're talking about long wavelength, right? You weren't talking about short distance. Yeah. So Planck depends upon the ability to veto out the large foreground signal, which contributes to B mode, because essentially all dust is emitting with E and B about equally. So that's something that you can't get away from. So because of the multi-frequency aspects, you do hope, certainly in large patches, that you'll be able to veto that out, and you can get to a detection. And the Planck value is nominally all sky. It would be sort of 0.01 to 0.02, but with the foregrounds, it's probably 0.04, 0.05, which is some of the numbers that I didn't show you about. And the same thing goes with the spider-like experiments, where you can actually choose your region of the sky so that it's a foreground minima. Then the numbers, as I was giving you, around plus or minus 0.02. So that's just the long wavelength aspect. Isocurvatures, there are already some crude perturbations or constraints on this that we've dealt with various data sets. That will improve enormously, primarily with Planck. Planck is a tremendous data set. It doesn't go out all the way like ACT, but it goes out far enough to be able to deal with many of these features. So there will be constraints on that. There will be very good constraints on cosmic strings, both at the power spectrum level and the attempt to do pattern recognition, which is there are specific patterns that are expected to be developed. So all of these things will move forward a lot. One thing that we can't really get away, you cannot circumvent, is the sample variance issue. So you cannot tell if we're having a rare statistical throw of the dice, or whether it's something fundamental. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad, because it gives a playground for people to play with.
Yeah, we have to have very quick, I'm afraid. Ruth?
I have a very quick question. Can Planck see the B modes from lensing?
Oh, it's going to be booming. Yeah, There's really no question about that.
Yes.
Oh, yes. The thing, though, one must always bear in mind is that given the other parameters, that's a direct, straightforward calculation. So in other words, it is the expectations are pretty straightforward, especially at the lower L's. I mean, you know, maybe 200 or so, where because of the additions, it's essentially Gaussian. And yes, much of interest will be done with that.
Let me just repeat one of Ben's questions, the one that you didn't answer.
Spatial curvature. Yeah. I can't tell you. I would have to look up what the expected development with Planck is. You improve if you add any extra information anyway. But really, the curvature should go down to the three-digit plus or minus. I mean, in other words, it's going to be very good indeed. Yeah, I mean, as you may recall, there is, if it's just microwave background, there is this whole degeneracy line that exists, except for the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, that says, well, you know, I can trade off lambda against the curvature. But what happens is that once you add other information, it closes that up. That's the thing that's allowed us already to target towards the curvature constraints are as small as they are already, but they will improve substantially. Maybe they will improve on the side of finding your primordial curvature.
Okay, Dick, I think we have to stop now. That's going to be very late, but thanks very much indeed, Dick. Now, we're running about